Okay, so welcome to part two of our discussion of Mechiras Chametz and the Harama question. Just to try to very quickly recap what we spoke about last week, so we know our story so far. So we started discussing the question that relates to the controversy surrounding Mechiras Chametz. The question of, is it a Harama, and if so, what are the implications of that? And that was the position, apparently. We'll talk a little bit more about it tonight, but that was the apparent position of the Bechor Shor writing in the 1700s, that Mechiras Chametz is basically a fake-out. It's presumably what he means when he calls it a harama, that it's not genuine. And he had a three-point claim. Each one, we'll see, is somewhat debatable, but his three points were that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, that it is insincere and not genuine, that haramos are acceptable only for rabbinic law and not for Torah law. And nonetheless, it is acceptable for the Mechiras Chametz that we do from our houses because we have performed bittul. And therefore, based on the Gemara in the first Parak of Psachim, bittul knocks the Isser down to a Drabanan. It deals with Vayira, Vayimatzeh on the level of Minha Torah. And therefore, indeed, we can rely on the Harama of Mechiras Chametz for our usages at home because we're dealing only with Yisur and Drabanan. So all three of those premises are subject to a lot of debate, and some of which we'll see a little bit more about tonight. And in examining this point, so we noted that the issue, or the question of Harama by Mechiras Chametz was brought up by the Rishonim, maybe even earlier, because the basis for the Mechiras Chametz that we have nowadays is the Tosefta, it's also Yerushalmi, that talks about somebody who's on a boat. And he finds himself stuck as Pesach approaches, and he has his chametz. Maybe it's his whole parnasa. Not clear, but that might be an assumption. So what's he going to do? So he's able, says the Tosefta, to transfer the ownership to a non-Jewish fellow traveler and reacquire it after Pesach. So that is brought in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. So that seems like that's the basis for what we do nowadays. However, not everyone is so convinced that it is indeed the basis, that maybe there are several circumstances there that do not match what we do nowadays, where we all sell our chametz planning way in advance, and we do it every year, and it's not necessarily tied up for our whole parnasa. So maybe there are some significant differences between the way we do it and what the Tosefta describes, and therefore this was a topic of a lot of debate. And it was already brought up in the time of at least the Rishonim. They have a phrase which either was put in by the Rishonim or is part of the Tosefta's Girsa, a Girsa of the Tosefta, so that's not clear. It's not 100% clear where it comes from. But there is the statement, Ubilvad Shaloyarim. So you can do this as long as it's not a harama. So we started exploring what that meant, and that there were at least three positions in the Rishonim to explain it. First was a problem for us if it was accepted by halacha. That was the view of the Ritva and a few others, that it means you can't do it every year. So that was definitely problematic for our contemporary practice. But that's not brought lahalacha at all. And we talked a little bit about why there would be such a concern, what exactly does that represent? Is that a general harama issue that maybe it's all kind of not ideal, so it should only be in situations that are of great need and rare, even though those two are not necessarily hav v'hav. It could be situations of need. Maybe it's a person's parnasa, but it does happen every year because it's always a constant situation. So they're not necessarily connected to each other, but that was a part of the suggestions. And I think we mentioned that the question of whether the boat is a necessary part of the picture or not. So the Tosefta talks about it being on the boat, makes it sound like it is kind of an unplanned situation, and the Shulchan Aruch doesn't bring that as part of its scenario, but the Rambam does. So does that mean anything for the implications? Some understood that that was the point, that it's described as happening on a boat because it's an unplanned kind of situation, not meant to be every year. But the Rambam doesn't otherwise give that indication. So there are some who suggest that the Rambam is actually making the opposite point, that even though you intended to go sell it somewhere else, you clearly have no interest in actually selling it to somebody who's on a boat with you while you're traveling, but you find yourself in the situation that Tosefta is telling you a chiddush l'kula, that even this kind of an insincere, ulteriorly motivated sale is still acceptable, even though without this you certainly would not have been selling it to somebody who's already on the boat with you. So in any event, this first consideration that it can't be every year would be a big problem for our practice, except that it's not quoted the halacha, so maybe we can breathe easy on that point. And we were in the middle of talking.
What's the definition of not every year? But therefore.
Therefore, why? What would it be the problem if you did it?
Yeah.
So that's not clear. So you could articulate it, and the truth is, one of the things that's beneath the surface here, and we'll see a few times, is that the whole argument about whether Mechiras Chametz is a harama or not, and if it is, does that matter so much? Is harama necessarily a bad thing, and is Mechiras Chametz a harama? Every step of this is debated. And a part of the debate is the concern about harama in the first place. Well, different machabrim are coming from different places. So there are at least two different ways you can articulate the concern about harama, and they're not all talking about the same thing, it seems. So one way to see it is that the concern is that you're evading the responsibility, that this is not really the way to do it, it's not really within the kavana of the Torah, and therefore that's problematic. And another way to say
but I did a bittul.
But to have this bittul itself, we have to figure out why that's not a harama. That's also, the Yerushalmi raises that concern, where you also find this phrase of ubavad shlo yarim. Some of the Rishonim actually apply that to bittul also. But even when you do the bittul, so the question is, does that necessarily take it out of this concern? That's something we'll revisit also. But there are apparently two different concerns here. So one concern, they're both hiding behind the harama, they're both representing themselves as the harama concern. One concern is that it's an evasion, that it's a way of getting out of what the real intent of the Torah is. The other concern is that it's fake, and that it's not a genuine sale. So the concern of the Ritva here probably is speaking to the first version, that it's probably about, it's just not right to do this regularly. So if you get stuck and you find yourself in an unplanned crisis, so okay, so then what can you do? You're going to lose your whole parnasa, it's just not tenable. So you'll have to deal with a letter of the law situation and not necessarily satisfy the spirit of the law so much. And that could be represented by the fact that, for example, the Tshuvas Laharis Nason, he quotes this Ritva in the context of other haramas. He says, you see, you saw here that you shouldn't do haramas regularly. You should only do them occasionally. But there's another way to read it, that maybe it's more about the sincerity of the sale and whether the sale is real or not. Because the Ritva himself, in saying this, he seems to suggest that if you were doing this on a regular basis, so then the chametz would actually be usur. In other words, as if the sale wouldn't really take place. So that's a more serious concern than just saying, that's not right to do this, you're getting around things. So it sounds like another way to understand it has to do with the second concern of haramos, that it's just an insincere process. And in that case, how is that relevant here? Because maybe, let's assume, as is often the case for us, you're dealing with the same non-Jewish purchaser from year to year. So he starts to catch on that, wait a minute, last year you did this and then you ended up buying it back afterwards or reacquiring it afterwards. So I'm starting to realize that this is a consistent pattern here. So maybe that means they're not going to take it seriously because they realize it always reverts. Or because they realize it always goes back, that maybe they feel like they have to take extra special care of it to protect it for you. And maybe that means it's not necessarily actually perceived as theirs. So there are ways of understanding this that it speaks to the second concern, that it's about the sincerity of the sales. So this is something that's particularly interesting, and you'll find this coming up again and again, that there are these two separate ways to understand what the concern is here, and not everyone who's addressing another is necessarily talking about the same concern, but there are represented maybe even in this one issue that maybe the Ritva's position that it shouldn't be done every year maybe reflects one or the other of those two concerns. But again, luckily for us, it doesn't seem to be brought lahalacha, and certainly not in the Shulchan Aruch. And even the Rambam, who does bring the boat as part of the picture, but doesn't seem to otherwise hold this, and indeed some who interpreted the Rambam understood him as making a point lakula by including the boat as a part of the scenario. So that's as far as the first interpretation that you find of Ubuvad Shaloyar. The second one sounds bad for us, but in the end of the day, maybe it's not as bad as it sounds. And that is, you have to at least take it out of your house. So on the surface, that sounds bad for us, because most of us do not take the chametz out of our house, actually, although there are people who do. There are people who are machmir for that, and more power to them. Certainly, it's not a bad chumrah to physically take the chametz out of your house if possible, but that's not necessarily possible for everyone. And especially when this really took off as a practice, so very often it was davka for those who really had their whole parnasa tied up in it and had inventory that they couldn't move, and perhaps also kalim that they couldn't move that was containing the chametz and the whiskey and the liquor, all of that they couldn't actually transfer location. So the question came up, how exactly to deal with this? And the Machzah Shekel in Taf Mem Ches, he also has a whole speech there about how he's so unhappy about how Mechiras Chametz has developed the way it has in the current generation his time, and that it's so far from what's described by the Tosefta, and it's not right, and it's all just a game. So that also deals with this whole question of maybe it was really only meant for those who have major Parnassa involvement in the situation. But again, the question of whether that's been accepted in the later generations is an open question. The Marashag, for example, has a tshuva where he says the attitude hasn't been to worry about this Machzah Shekel at all. That's all a part of the ongoing debate. So what about the fact that we don't actually move it out of our houses? So the Bach addressed this, and since then, what we do is we do mark it off in an area in our house, and we should certainly try to make sure we're not going to encounter it in the normal course of living in our house, and we also transfer the ownership of that area. So it's a question how exactly we do that. We'll come back to it in a second. But also together with that, so we're supposed to provide the key to the purchaser. And just how important that is, and if it's necessary at all, was a big debate also among Achronim. Some thought it was completely unnecessary, some thought it was very necessary, and there's actually a two-pronged concern there. That one is that if you don't provide access to the purchaser, that's the bigger concern, that's the bigger issue, that the purchaser should have access, because if he's buying it, he should be able to get it for himself. And also, the concern is that if you are holding back too much access for yourself, so then the purchaser may get the sense that it's not a serious sale. If you're really giving it to somebody else, then why do you need to exert any kind of control over it, any kind of access, any kind of marking that indicates that it's yours? So all of these details were debated. The Mishnah Berurah writes that he thinks it's pashut, you don't have to actually give him the key, but just show him where the key is. And nowadays, different versions have developed that now we have cell phones, which means you can tell the purchaser how to reach you at any time, and maybe your door has a combination lock, so you can tell them how to get into the combination lock, or the neighbor has the keys. Different ways have evolved as far as addressing the key issue of the key. And again, just how important it is also a part of the debate. And some said that it's depends on what exactly it's messaging, that if you, let's say, you lost the key, so you're not necessarily holding it back as a siman of your control, so maybe that makes a difference. Maybe it's different kinds of messages depending on what the circumstances are. And there are positions in the middle, so for example, you know, the Behuda held that it was very important to give over the key, but he also argued strongly against those who said that if you don't give the key, then, or let's say afterwards, you take the key back, which many were very against, but he says you can't say that invalidates the sale, because the sale was still done on its terms. So the fact that you also send mixed messages, that's wrong to do l'chafila, but he wouldn't say that that's something you can say invalidates the sale, because the sale still exists on its own terms. So the role of the key in this is a part of it, but what about also the transfer of the area of the house where it is? So the Avnei Nezer and a number of other Achronim after him were very concerned that you should not sell that area, but rather you should rent it. And that idea is also embedded within the Harama concern, because the way, and also perhaps to both halves of it, but the way some of the Achronim expressed it is that, okay, so we can believe that you're selling your chametz over the duration of Pesach and you're not going to be using your chametz and your alternative is to destroy it. So I can believe you're genuinely selling your chametz. But it's very hard to make a plausible case that you're actually selling a part of your house that you live in the rest of it, and that there's no actual marketability to a part of the house that other people are living in, and there's no actual value anyone can get out of buying just a part of the house. So many felt that to sell the house is a open harama, that's something that is clearly fake, and therefore renting it, that has to be the way to go, and not selling it. So that was also a debate. There were those who felt selling it tafku was necessary for other reasons. It's also, the sale of the house is also, the part of the house is also used now as one of the kinyanim that we use for transferring the chametz, because the kinyan agav is one way that you can make a kinyan by selling land and then selling the metaltalin with it. And it's especially helpful because if we're not actually allowing for a mashicha, if they can't actually take the chametz physically and move it, so then throwing in the kinyan agav may be a crucial help to this whole story. So the Bach had that this house should be sold. That was the way some of the Akronim also felt, specifically sold. And others felt, no, that that is actually going to be more of a harama, so you can sell the chametz, but the part of the house, that dafka has to be rented. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva like that also, and others have tshuvas like that, because in addition to the plausibility issue, there's the legality issue. So you can't sell real estate so easily. You can't claim that you're selling a part of the house and it's not going to be recorded in the register anywhere or in the deed, and all of the other legal regulations that usually go along with selling any kind of real estate. So perhaps renting it, okay, there it's easier to conform that it's being done legally and that it actually could be true. But to say that you're selling it, so many thought that that was a harama. This comes up in a lot of other areas of halacha. So, for example, there were some achronim who wrote that the reason you can't sell your business for Shabbos and sell your field for Shabbos and have people do malacha in it, among other issues, is because it's not plausible to say that you're actually selling your house or selling your field for just a day. If you want to rent it, so that people do, but to say that won't help you for the Shabbos purposes. But to say you're actually selling it, so that's not going to be plausible. Or to talk about avelus, somebody wants to sell his business during the time he's going to be in avelus, and sell the place where it is. So again, there was an objection in the Achronim. They said it's not plausible that you actually, just so that you don't lose a week's work, that you're going to actually sell your property for that time. So there was a big concern that selling land in a temporary way is not really credible. The Vavaji Yosef in the Tshuva, he says a big problem with take that position. He's not willing to take that position because that would invalidate the Hetz Mechira for Shemitah, that there we have to be selling actual real estate. And if we're going to say that a temporary sale of real estate is not plausible, so then that would seem to call into question that to Mechira, so he wasn't so accepting of that position. So it was a big debate in general, and it also, like so many of the issues here in Mechira's Chametz, all revolves around the harama concern, that we don't want to have a harama, we're only limited in our tolerance for haramas, and therefore, so we can handle the selling of the chametz, but selling of the part of the house and saying that that's at all real. There were achronim who were very opposed to that, and therefore insisted that instead of a sale, it has to be a rental. So that's as far as this second interpretation of the harama, that it's about moving out of the house. So it sounds bad for us, but the end of the day, we seem to have dealt with it in a way that poskim are okay with, even though the detail of whether it's a rental or a sale continues to be a debated point. But what about a third interpretation? So a third interpretation may, on a very superficial level, sound like it's bad for us, but it's also not as bad as it sounds. And that is that it cannot be a matana amanas lahachzir, that you cannot transfer this, whether as a gift or as a sale. So in the case of the Tosefta, it sounds like it's talking about a gift. So that's where you find the language of Matana Manas Lahachzir, but let's say doing it as a sale. So to condition the sale, Amanas Lahachzir. So that is understood by many to also be a, and probably this may be the dominant view among the three, or together with the second one, that that is prohibited by the No Harama clause, that we find in this scenario. So is that a problem for us? So not really, because we do not transfer our chametz with a contingent clause that it has to be almanas lahachzir. Now, that's important to clarify on a number of levels. So you may say, well, doesn't our chametz always come back to us? So yes, but the sale was not contingent on that and wasn't contingent on anything else. It's very important we don't make the sale contingent on anything. The worst mistake to make, we'd make the sale contingent on full payment, because since he doesn't end up paying it, so then that would invalidate the sale retroactively and we'd accomplish nothing. So certainly we don't make the sale contingent on full payment, but generally we don't make the sale contingent on anything. And we don't make a contingent on return or resale either. What generally happens in our practice nowadays is that he has the opportunity to pay the balance of the value of the chametz after Pesach, a week after he originally purchases it. He puts a very small, very, very small down payment on the value of the chametz. And if he decides after Pesach he wants to keep it, so then he's entitled to keep it. He has to pay the value or pay the value of whatever he wants to keep. And we can't object to that. That's part of this sincere sale condition. But in general, he doesn't usually want to keep it, so he doesn't want to pay the rest in order to keep it, so he usually sells it back. But again, sells it back and not just gives it back because it was a contingent sale, because that would be a big problem, but rather he transfers it back as a new kinyan to the original seller after Pesach instead of having to pay the balance. But it's not made as a matana almanas lahachzir or as a sale almanas lahachzir. Now, the truth is, it's a big question, so what would be so terrible if it was? So it's a sugi in the Gemara that matana almanas lahachzir shmei matana, that if you give a matana for a temporary time, so during that time, it is considered to be the property of the recipient. So later on, he has to give it back to you. But while he has it, this comes up in Hilchos Lulav and other areas we're familiar with, that it is considered to be the property of the recipient during the time that he has it. So why is it that that's no good? So that was also a discussion. So is that more fundamental or is that more about the message? So some understand that it's more just about the whole evasion concern, that that's already too much. That even if it's technically going to be his property, but that's already too much of a fake out to say that that's how you're going to handle your chametz with a gift to somebody else that he's obligated to give back to you. So they thought maybe mishum mechum medechametz and mishum the whole attitude, that's what makes it problematic and not because it's inherently an issue. Others thought that maybe there was inherently an issue, that first of all, maybe he's now going to worry about it staying in good shape because he's obligated to give it back to you. So that kind of means that he's watching it on your behalf. So maybe that creates a interest on behalf of the original Jew because now it's being watched for him. Others didn't think that was necessarily such a concern. And others articulated it that maybe having any kind of a condition is just too dangerous, at least for the purposes of Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh, that whether you call it ownership or not, even if you say Matana Manas Lahachzir Shnei Matana, but there is the concern always that maybe he won't fulfill the condition. And then retroactively, it won't end up having been in his possession. And therefore, A, maybe that's scary. Maybe that's not the confidence level we're willing to take on. Or there are those who said even more so. Maybe that's not satisfactory for Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh. Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh, you have to actually transfer it with complete Gemiras Das. And if there's the possibility that it's not going to be a sale and it's going to retroactively turn out that it was never his, so then that's not good enough. So you could phrase it just as risky, that maybe he's not going to come through with a clause and will retroactively be negated, so maybe it's risky. And some understood it as more than risky, not that we're worried that's actually going to happen, but that the very possibility that it's contingent on anything, maybe that's not considered to be enough of a transfer for the purposes of Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh. We can't say that you've really taken it to that extent. You can't say that you've really accomplished it through that. This is related also to the previous point, because just like it's not 100% clear why there should be a problem technically for matanam nas lahachzir, so it's also not clear why it has to be taken out of your house. So that whole second concern, and what we were really trying to address with the key and with the rent of the land and the like, so it's not clear al pidin why it has to be taken out of your house, because the halacha is that chametz of a non-Jew that's in the house of a Jew does not constitute a violation of Ba'ira Ba'imatzeh. So if you're indeed selling it, so then why can't it stay in your house? So again, there are those who felt that that was related to the Harama concern, that since already there's so much here that's weakening things, that for it to be in your house, that's already too much. Or maybe related to that, just as a very practical concern that you're actually going to come and eat it. So if a non-Jew actually has his own chametz that's stored in your house, so then, okay, we could say you're not likely to come and eat it. But this chametz that you know is coming back to you and the whole story and whatever else we're afraid of, and it's also accessible, so then maybe we're more worried that you're going to come to eat it. So in both cases, this interpretation number two and interpretation number three, so we try to factor them both in, but it's not clear in the Ikra HaDin why they're necessary, and it could be for a number of possible explanations why it is that we do have these conditions, that there should be some way in which it is considered not in your property, and that there should be also no absolute condition that it get returned to you. There are some who suggest, or the Shnorbach and others, that maybe the idea of taking it out of your house is a different way of trying to address the Bechor Shor. That maybe if he's right, that you can only have a harama for drabanans. So there are a number of Rishonim and Achronim who maintain that chametz that you own, but that is not in your house, you're not in violation of Ba'irah, Ba'yamatzim, and HaTorah. That's only midrabanan. So maybe that knocks it down to a drabanan, and maybe that's why you want that to go along with the Mechiras chametz, that since those who believe it's a harama and that can only be used for drabanans, so then maybe locating it in somebody else's house also makes it a drabanan, and maybe that's why the condition was there. So these are a few of the takes on the harama issue, but the question of not having it come back to you, so that also is somewhat limited in terms of what it actually means. So we agree that you can't actually have it conditioned on return to you, and it shouldn't be contingent on anything, but certainly can't be conditioned on having it returned to you. But we come otherwise pretty close. So this is something that the Trumas Adeshin discussed, and later posts can quote from the Trumas Adeshin, and here there's also a phrase that comes from the earlier sources, the different Gersos. But what they quote is that it's legitimate for the Jew, when selling the chametz to the non-Jew, to indicate to him, you know, don't be so quick to sell this to anyone else, you'll get a better deal from me. So after Pesach, a week from now, you think you may want to sell this, you'll get a better profit if you sell it to me. Or you'll keep in mind that you may have an opportunity to sell it back to me, and think about that in terms of how you plan your ownership here, that much is legitimate. You're not making it actually contingent, but the fact that you're dealing with somebody you know and who you trust, and that you're also indicating to him that you're going to be interested in it at a later date, so none of that is considered to be a violation of this clause, that you can't make it absolutely contingent on your terms. So you can come close, but you can make it basically clear on what the expectation is, but you can't make that an absolute requirement. Now, there is a particularly fascinating discussion, I thought, that also relates to the whole mentality behind Mechiras Chametz that addresses that point. And there is a fascinating tshuva of Amasis Binyamin, who was writing in the 1600s, and he dealt with a situation which the later poskim seemed to note, but in very much bekitzer, and it's worth reading the Amasis Binyamin inside, because the way he describes the whole scenario is very, very impactful. And he talks about the following problem, that since the Jews would sell their chametz to a non-Jew, and they would sell it for a very small token amount, and then after Pesach, so they would then come to buy it back, and they would give the original purchaser a little bit more, so he makes a little bit of a profit. So there were not so scrupulous Jews who realized that, okay, so this non-Jewish purchaser is holding on to a lot of chametz that he paid very little for, and he's about to be given a very small markup for it back. So you could swoop in and give him a little bit more of a markup, or get it first, and you can get a whole lot of chametz for very cheap. So there were these not so honest Jews, or not so scrupulous Jews, who were swooping in and taking away the chametz from the Jews who originally had sold it with the expectation of getting it back, and that was threatening to destroy the whole system. So the Masses B'Yamin writes, very evocative there, he says, this, he couldn't sleep at night, he didn't know what to do about this, so he's got to find a solution, because as was often the case, so the Jews were involved in liquor business or whatever it was that was chametz connected, and their whole parnasa depended on them finding some way to be able to sell the chametz over the course of Pesach rather than destroy it, but also to be able to come back and get it after Pesach so that they can continue making a living. And if they can't do that because they're going to get undermined by somebody else, so then the whole system's going to fall apart. But to make it contingent on the return to the first Jew, they can't do that either. So what's the solution? So he said he couldn't rest until he found a solution, and he did. So he discusses there that there are certain areas in halacha where we find that there is a special preference, a right of first refusal, that's given to somebody who had already invested a certain amount. So for example, let's say you have the sugya of ani hamahafeh b'charara, that somebody who's already invested in a certain market and somebody else comes in and swoops in on his investment, so we say that that person is doing the wrong thing, that that's not proper for you to capitalize on somebody else's effort and then try to take their business. So using that, using another approach, he was able to articulate that there are situations where it doesn't actually create a condition that's binding on the non-Jewish purchaser. He still has the right to sell it to whoever he wants. But the Jewish new buyer who wants to buy it from him, you can tell him that it's also for him to do that, that he's in violation of Ani HaMahafet B'Harara, he's in violation of other related dinim. So he was able to come up with an approach where, yes, the sale was still open and free, and the non-Jewish purchaser still has the right to do whatever he wants, but a Jewish interloper who would try to interfere with this market, this is at least as much as Ani HaMahafet B'Harara, this guy has invested at least as much in this market as somebody who is already trying to set up a business somewhere, or somebody who already spread out a fishing net. The fish haven't come yet, but you're already interfering in the efforts that he put there, so that's at least as much the case here. So he did articulate this position that you could say that there was a prohibition, an enforceable prohibition, on a Jewish interloper from buying it for himself, but at the same time it was still not contingent on anything as far as the non-Jewish purchaser is concerned, and he still is able to buy it and maintain his right to sell it whoever he wants to, even though he's going to end of the day, going to end of the week, end up going to sell it to the original Jewish purchaser. And so far, so good. So there was also an equally fascinating analysis of the Tshuvas B'Dayasha by Shmuel ben Yosef Alevi. And he articulated an understanding which is very interesting as far as how this is concerned, whether this necessarily fits with all of the assumptions the way we do it nowadays. Maybe yes, maybe no, but it was very interesting also in showing the concern for Harama and how he avoided it and how he understood the whole deal was going on. So he was concerned about the idea that the non-Jewish purchaser pays very little to get the chametz, pays very little up front, and it's not really credible that he has any possibility of paying the whole thing. He doesn't have that kind of capital that he's ever going to be able to pay back the whole thing. Now, parentheses, there are poskim who are very concerned about that. So, for example, Rabbi Willig is very concerned about that nowadays. So that's why he's mocked it all these years to sell to John J. Brown, and after he passed away 2 years ago, to try to find somebody of a comparable capabilities, because to sell it, as most other people do, to sell it to somebody who clearly has no financial capacity to buy it. So there were those who felt that that was really problematic, and that Rabbi Willig insisted on selling it to somebody who maybe doesn't have all the money in his own account, but he's a businessman that he could put together enough of a chevra. If he wanted to actually keep all the chametz, he could find a way to raise the funds and he could buy it. So the Big Dayesha was concerned that he, and others have pointed, this is part of what the Bechor Shor mentioned also, they talk about Arum Yachav, Ariel Yachav, this barefoot non-Jew who doesn't seem to be wealthy, doesn't seem to have any kind of business involvement, and he is supposed to buy all this expensive chametz. It doesn't sound so credible. So the Big Yeshua was worried about that. How could you credibly maintain that this non-Jewish purchaser who doesn't have much of a bank account and is not paying very much to get the chametz that he's getting? So how could you say that's credible? And especially, why don't we assume that, okay, we understand that the Jew has to sell it. The Jew is highly motivated to sell it because it's going to, the clock is ticking and it's going to become worthless. So fine. So he has to sell it immediately and maybe take a loss because the alternative is a complete loss. But why shouldn't he try to find the highest bidder? Why shouldn't he try to find somebody who can pay more than this guy? So it's one thing to go back to the vote scenario. So maybe the person he sold it to was the only person he could find. So, all right, so he sold it to this one non-Jew on the boat who was able to be the purchaser. But if that's not the case, if there are other people around, there are other non-Jews around, so why doesn't he look to find the most he could find? He's selling this chametz at a loss anyway, so he'll probably be able to auction it off and find people who will pay more than others. So the Big Yeshua was bothered by that also. So how is it credible to say that he's selling it for a low price to this not rich individual when there probably were people he could have sold it for more? All of that seems very suspicious. So to that, he articulated the whole Mahalach here, which he says makes total sense, and the way he describes it, it does make total sense. And he said, this way it's not a haram at all, and he repeatedly says that it has to be, there's no haram at all, that you're going to sell chametz, it has to be sincere, you're dealing with a Yisr Deraiso, it has to be a genuine sale without any harama. And so the way he describes it, he says there is no harama involved. So what's going on? So basically, yes. So you're a Jew whose chametz is about to become worthless. So let's say your chametz is worth $10,000. So you will find this non-Jewish purchaser, and you're going to sell it to him for $10. All right, so why are you doing that? And why is he buying it? Because here's the deal, and this could be a win-win situation. So you tell this non-Jewish purchaser that you can't look around for anybody more because you would like to maximize your value, but it's going to be Pesach and you can't hold on to it anymore. So here's the deal. I'm selling it to non-Jew number one for a low amount. And the idea is that then the non-Jew can look around over the course of Pesach and maybe he can find another non-Jew who will pay him close to the full value, who will pay maybe said $1,000, they'll pay $900 to get a good deal. And then he'll take a cut, and he'll give most of it back to the original Jew, and he'll make a profit, and it's a win-win situation. So the non-Jewish purchaser will be able to be basically a wholesaler for your chametz, and a retailer for the chametz. He'll take it on consignment from the Jew, and he'll sell it for something close to its full value, and then he'll be able to make a profit, and he'll then return the rest of the value to the Jew. So theoretically, that all makes sense. That could be a benefit for everybody. So the original Jew could get as much of the value as he potentially could, and the non-Jewish purchaser has potential to make a profit, even though it's not super likely, but it's possible. So he's motivated to do that, and he doesn't have to have the capital himself, because that was never the idea, that he's not necessarily going to end up paying for it. If he succeeds over the course of Pesach finding a better buyer, so then he'll have the full value, and then he'll give that back to the Jew. But if he doesn't, so then the Jew will come to him after Pesach and say, okay, you weren't able to sell it, so I'll buy it back from you, and I'll give you a modest profit. We'll get a little bit more. So still a win-win. So the non-Jewish purchaser has potential, small potential for a big profit, a guarantee of a little profit, because he'll at least make something for selling it back to the original Jew, so it makes sense for him. Doesn't matter that he doesn't have the wherewithal to otherwise pay for it himself, and basically makes sense for everyone involved. So it's basically at least a potential win-win, no lose for everybody involved, and everybody's acting rationally. So the Big Day Yeshua understood that that's what's going on, and there's no harama involved at all. And we have to insist that there's no haram involved at all. That's very important for it, but that's basically how everything makes sense. And that was how he understood it. But that was a pretty fascinating way of explaining it. Whether or not that's actually the understanding everybody has nowadays, it's a good question, but at least there's a concept. So that was how the Vigdayesha understood, and it does seem to be a neat explanation that everything can fall into place. So with that, so let's just, we're going to have a part three and probably a part four of this, but to take a few more minutes, we'll set up part three. So the question of whether there is a harama here, so we see that there was a big debate about this, and that the Bechor Shor had thought that it was a harama, and therefore had the limitations that he maintained. And we saw that the Rishonim already had talked about this, and that it seems like they addressed the question of harama, and if we are able to stick to these conditions, so then maybe we have answered that. So there are a few other details to consider here as far as this whole relationship, and it's also noteworthy, alluded to before, that some of the Rishonim said that the same concern was relevant to Bittel, which also seems to be basically a kind of superficial way to deal with the Chametz situation, and there we don't say it's questionable. The Gemara says it's an obligation, but we have to do Bittel, and yet some of the Rishonim also throw in the concern there that they have the same phrase, Ubavad Shlo Yarim, that you have to do it in a sincere way and understand that that shouldn't be considered to be a game. So to go back to the Bechor Shor, so there are a couple of important points to consider. So first of all, the assumption that he felt that Mechiras Chametz actually was a harama is not necessarily the bottom line. And the Stechemek points this out, and there are some other Svarim that also point this out. The Bechor Shor has has a big reputation among his contemporaries and those later. They all speak of him with great reverence, and also many of them were related to him. So some of his descendants and his nephews and his grandchildren were Mechaber Svarim. So the Beis Ephraim, for example, was his grandson, and he wrote a whole sefer to defend the Bechor Shor on this. And others in his family also are Mechaber Svarim. And what emerges from some of them is really in the original text is that the Bechor Shor doesn't necessarily conclude that Mechiras Chametz actually is a harama. So what was the context of what he's talking about? So if it's going to become prohibited, so then he might as well sell it sincerely, because it's better than losing the whole thing. So given that those are the only two choices, so maybe he actually is sincere about that. But when it comes to the animals, so that is not going to be sincere about, because who could believe that somebody's actually selling these valuable animals to, again, people who aren't in the business and can't afford to pay for the whole animal, and he's not actually moving the animals. So that's really a harama, to believe that you're actually selling the animals with all of that. So that I can't really buy, that I can't really, no pun intended, that I can't really believe. And the motivation is just to save a week of getting skinnier, so it doesn't sound credible that you're actually going to transfer the ownership of your valuable animals to somebody who can't pay for them just for a week, just so that what you gain, what's your motivation, so that they'll be fed at the same level for that week. That doesn't sound so credible. But your actual chametz, that if you don't sell with great sincerity, with true sincerity, is going to become worthless. Okay, maybe so. So that was a big question, whether even the Bechor Shor himself concluded that it was a harama.
How about Mechiras Chametz as a support for the Bittel?
So there are some who understand that also. So just we'll have to continue this next week. But just to
solidify the idea of Bittel, it shows that my Bittel really is real. And if you don't believe me, just to show I really don't want this Chametz, basically.
So we'll expand on that next week. But the point is that it may actually do the opposite. So that was a part of the concern. So just to say a little bit more about how the Bechor Shor has influenced things. So the Bechor Shor, it's a big debate about all of his points, but some accept the Bechor Shor. So for example, we can mix and match in all different ways. So some accept the Bechor Shor that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, regardless of what we just said, that may not be his maskana, but some accept that, and therefore that it should be limited to drabanans. But they don't necessarily accept his third premise, because his third premise that our chametz is drabanan because of bittel, so that is highly problematic, because many argue, understandably, that the chametz that you are selling is not the same chametz that you're being mevatel. And in fact, it's highly problematic to say that it is, because how can you credibly maintain that there's a bittul there if you're then transacting with it? Bittul.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, right, there are some who say
I'm
like that.
Doing the aroma in order just to magnify my bittul. But enoch anami is aroma. I'm telling you, it's not an aroma. I have no problem with being aroma, because really my bittul is really what's picking it in. And to prove that my bittul is right, I don't even want this comment. I would even sell this enoch anami lima from the good unto.
So there are parts that have been mixed and matched in all these different directions. So there are some who maintain like that, that it's dafka about combining it with the bittul as an extra safeguard. But there are those who felt that it actually causes a problem, that to maintain that you're doing both is a stira, that to say that you could...
But in other words, I understand the stira.
Right, I understand what you're saying, that just in case the bittul doesn't work, so then
no,
I'm...
No, I'm saying the bittul works, and I'm just trying to prove that I don't... The problem with the bittul is, well, that's how famous Sranarol is, well, at the end of the day, the chametz is in front of me, right?
Right. But not necessarily. But not necessarily, because that was actually a machlokas rishonim, even though most rishonim were makel on this, but it was about two girsos in the Rambam. It was a machlokas rishonim whether bittul even works by chametz yadua.
Right.
So you could say that a really medakdik yid will just try to get rid of all chametz completely, and then does a bittul in case there's anything under the couch. But to have visible... Right, but which is not necessarily the dominant shita. But there's all kinds of different ways to mix and match this. So you could say that you're really not actually, some people may say we're really machmir, even though this is also debatable. And so they're not actually dealing with any chametz whatsoever. But they're, as far as they can tell, getting rid of every scrap of chametz. Then they're doing bittul just in case there's anything. And then they'll go through a sale also. They go to the rabbi and say, yeah, if there's anything anywhere, then I'm selling that too. So you, there are those who understood that was the purpose, that you're actually covering all your bases by doing that. And there were those who felt that that's not a good way to go about things. But if you're actually selling identifiable chametz, not just as a catch-all, saying, if there's anything, I'm selling it, but you actually have chametz that you know about that you're selling. So to say that bittul was also done on that chametz, and you're selling it, and you know you're going to get it back later.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually saying I'm encouraging the haroma. I'm saying
okay.
I want it to be a haroma, but it, all it's doing is that according to the shita that says that I can have bittul even on haroma to yadua, but in order to magnify that point that I really want this chametz, I'm doing some sort of a haroma just to show I want nothing to do with this chametz. But if not, it doesn't work.
It's an interesting take. I mean, to give it away, you could say it's consistent with that, but to sell it, especially if you end up getting it back, it's a little bit of a harder sell. No pun intended.
But I'm saying it's not a sale. No one's buying the chametz. It's not happening. The whole thing is just to show that I don't want this chametz.
So it could be, but then there are probably better ways to show that by, you know, actually just burning it. And
you're not going to burn because you want chametz back, and that's why I'm doing the bittul.
But that's the problem. Bittul because you want it back. That's what the Yerushalmi was afraid of when the Yerushalmi said that if you... Well, if we say it's two separate tracks, like many understand, then maybe it's more workable. The bittul is on the chametz that you don't know about, that's under the couch. And the sale is on the rest of the chametz. And then we have to make sure that the sale is sincere. So there were different ways to understand this, and there were those who were makabel, the Bechor Shor, in part but not in whole, and there were those who mixed and matched. So if you could say that the bittul and the sale were both working on the same chametz, so that was debatable. There were those who felt yes and those who felt no. And connected to that also was a big machlokas. If you're doing both, what should you do first? So does it undo the bittul to sell it? Because when you're bittul, you declare you're being vatal all the chametz. So then maybe if you left over any to sell, so maybe that undermines the bittul, and it undermines the bittul on everything. Because then it's as if your whole bittul was phony, and even though the bittul that you would have meant is maybe undermined. That's how some felt. And others felt that it should dafke be the other way around. You should do the bittul before the sale. So that was a big machlokas also. But there also are those who are makabel the Bechor Shor halfway, in either direction. So, for example, some accepted him lakula and said that, okay, they accept the part that the bittul is effective to knock it down to a derabbanan. And for that reason, they were very makel about the sale. That they said that you could rely on various kulas because we're only dealing with rabbanans. And others, Davka, argued on that point. Like the Prichadish says, no, you have to assume that we need this on the level daraisa, and therefore the sale has to be legitimate. No haramis in the sale. Sale has to be 100%. Don't assume, like the Bechor Shor, lakula, that it's only a rabbanan because of the bittul. And there are others who took the Bechor Shor only lechumra, and who said that they agree that you can't do that. There's a harama involved here, and they agree they can't use a harama for their isa, but they didn't necessarily accept the bittul part. So then, what would that mean? So it could be, like we said before, that maybe there are other ways to knock it down toward rabbanan, such as taking it out of the house. Maybe that was meant to address that. Or there are many who have a chumra, and this is pretty common, that they don't sell chametz daraisa. So they don't actually sell the bread and the cereals. They only sell the rabbanan chametz, and that could reflect the Bechor Shor. Or it could be just more simple, that they just feel the whole thing is questionable, or maybe that we're not able to follow all the details in a proper way. So for whatever reason, they have come to the conclusion that they should only use mechiras chametz for chametz that is inherently drabbanan, and not just made drabbanan by some external mechanism like bittul or moving it some other way. So many do have that chumra for various reasons. The Tzitz Eliezer writes in his tshuva, though, as others felt as well, that he knows many great Talmidei Chachamim who sold chametz gamer and right after Pesach served that chametz to very righteous guests. So not everyone had this kpeda at all. But to those who did, it could be connected to the Bechor Shor, or it could be connected to any type of mixing and matching of these various views. So we'll have to pick up with that next week. But what we'll try to address next week is, I have to get further in, so we'll get all of this before Pesach. But we'll also discuss that in order to try to make Mechiras Chametz more solid and less of a vulnerable to harama kind of situation, there were various remedies and enhancements that were suggested, and some of those remedies then turned out to be sources of great controversy on their own. So God willing, next week we'll discuss some of those controversies. Because I'll be in a different time zone, I'll probably record it and send it out and probably not try to have it live, but we'll see if there's any alternative to that. But in any event, I look forward to communicating with you one way or another, and you should have a fantastic night. Yeshikach. Thank you.